On this episode of Newt's World, on December 9th, 2021, when most of us were getting ready for the upcoming holidays, the town of Yuma, Arizona was facing a tough challenge, a surge of migrants crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. Yuma's mayor, Douglas Nichols, announced a state of emergency over the border crisis. In October and November of 2020, U.S. Customs and Border Protection encountered 1,777 people illegally crossing the border into Yuma. In 2021, that number grew to 44,512 in the same two-month period, a staggering 2,405% increase. And Mayor Nichols expects more than 250,000 migrants to cross the border into Yuma in 2022. To help us understand more about the issues that Yuma's facing, I'm really pleased to welcome my guest, Mayor Douglas Nichols. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me on, Speaker. I appreciate the opportunity to kind of give the Yuma perspective.
Let me start with a sort of pre-crisis question, because I'm always fascinated. And of course, the American system relies so heavily on local leadership and local government. What got you involved in running for office and serving your community?
Well, it's a little bit of a long story, but I'll try to shorten it a little bit. I grew up in Yuma. When I was young, I didn't appreciate the community and looked for my quickest way out, and that was college. And then in college, my high school sweetheart and I stayed together and we got married after college. She too grew up in Yuma and was eager to leave. And that was until the first kid came along. And we were living in the Phoenix area. And that first kid, who's now 24, changed our lives, changed our perspective on what was important. We realized living in a community like Yuma where it's relatively safe, I can go to work and go to the kids' play in the middle of the day, volunteer, and do that without having to commit a whole bunch of travel time and a whole bunch of resources and catch up with our family who was still here. So we returned to Yuma in 1999, and upon returning, made a promise to each other that we would do what we could to help our community on all different levels, just make it better, give back to the community that helped raise us. And with that, I joined Rotary, and we've gotten really involved in our church and such. And one day at Rotary, well, just to let you know, I'm a civil engineer by trade. So I am a typical engineer in that I prefer not to speak in public, and I prefer to talk to my shoes and not to new people. But there was this opportunity to take over for a council member who was leaving their seat 5 months early. And I thought that would be an interesting way to understand the community. Never had a political motivation for any of it. It was just more to understand. Went in, did the 5 months, got to go to Washington, D.C., got to go to the state capitol, did the advocacy, kind of saw how things put together, and basically saw the impact you could have. Got out of that office, and during the next mayor term, I was approached by some business leaders who I'd gotten to know through all these philanthropic activities, and they said, "We want you to run for mayor." And I said, "I don't know why?" And they kind of explained their reasons, which I won't go into here. But it really fit into that early mission that Danette and I, and my wife, committed to each other. And that was to do our part to give back to the community. And so I have my own small business. And if the community is not growing and has solid leadership, my business is not going to survive. And so we agreed it would be something we would do one term at a time. And well, we're at the end of the second term. And it looks like we're going to go for a third. It just became, for me, another engineering problem. There's things that need to get fixed. How do we break down the parts, get it done, and move on to the next thing and continue to look to move the community forward?
But I get the impression, if you don't mind my commenting, that while you may have been educated as a civil engineer and you may have sort of an engineer's methodical approach to things, you're really an engineer who likes people.
I do like people. I will say, though, at the very beginning, I was petrified of speaking. I try to write every speech. That didn't work. My city administrator tried to write a few speeches. That didn't work. And I just had to force myself to grow into talking in public, talking on national TV, things that would have scared me to death 10 years ago. I don't know if it's numb or used to it, but one way or the other, it served me okay.
First of all, let me just ask you, is Yuma the town and the county, or how wide is the connection there?
So there's actually three things when we say Yuma it could be. It could be the city of Yuma, could be the county of Yuma, or it could even be the Yuma Border Patrol sector, which doesn't exactly align. So when we refer to migrants coming into Yuma, it's the Yuma Border Patrol sector. So it's a little bit confusing, but that's the lay of the land.
So you're the mayor of the town of Yuma, which, as I understand it, has about 96,000 population.
That's the census numbers, which we disagree with. We think we're over 100,000, about 108, but yeah, it's in that ballpark.
Okay. But that would mean, if you're correct in your projections, that 250,000 migrants coming through a town of 100,000 is a staggering burden.
It is. And if you compare that to the countywide, the county is under 220,000. So it even crests the whole county. And so those numbers are, they're daunting, because if it gets to the point where it got in the middle of December, where it's completely out of containment, then we're talking about thousands of people walking around the community without resources or ability to get anywhere. And that's why the emergency came out.
Let me ask one or two more questions. You're about 3 hours southwest of Phoenix, is that right?
Right. We're right in the middle between Phoenix and San Diego at the Arizona-California border, as well as the Mexico border. So we're kind of tucked in the corner. About 70% of our economy is agriculture. And we have two military bases that makes up another good 15%, and on from there. But that's where we're located geographically, on the Colorado River.
So the problem, which is, I thought, sort of beginning to get under control, has now really exploded. And apparently there was a 5-day period in December where you had over 6,000 migrants cross the U.S.-Mexico border into Yuma. I mean, it's almost like a wave of people.
It is a wave. It was a building wave, and that's part of what contributed to the situation, is Border Patrol had these ever-increasing numbers, and their capacity just was full. So when these 6,000 people hit, it was like trying to, you know, shove a fire hose through a straw. It just was backing up. And what we had was people who normally would be collected or picked up by Border Patrol waiting along the border. They weren't seeing any Border Patrol for hours and hours, and up to a day. And so they just started walking into the community. It's about a 3-mile walk before you hit the actual city. So when you get that far, and then you got to find the Border Patrol station. And some of them mistook the police station for that Border Patrol station or firehouse. They'd show up at our homeless shelters. So it was a bit chaotic for 2 to 3 days of some heavy foot traffic. And foot traffic is lightly, because some of them took Ubers. Some of them called 911 to try to get the police or sheriff to give them a ride. But all of them were on the move at some point.
I was just thinking, given what your summers get to be like in that part of the country, if people come walking across in 115, 120 degree weather, I mean, isn't there a real health hazard to them?
Very much so. And they get abandoned frequently by the coyotes who bring them across. So last year, I believe the number was almost 40 people perished in the desert trying to come into the country. Border Patrol becomes pretty much a life safety rescue organization during the summer months, because when it's 120 on the temperature bulb, it's, you know, cresting 130, and you can't possibly carry enough water in some of the locations that people try to cross.
Walk me through this for a minute, just at a very human kind of level. I'm sitting somewhere, Haiti, Africa, you know, Guatemala. I decide to come to the U.S. I probably end up hiring somebody, one of the cartels or somebody, to help me get across. And I get across. What am I thinking? I mean, where do I think I'm going?
Well, so that's a great question, because I think as Americans, a lot of times we romanticize this I'm just going to take a leisurely walk into the United States and everything's roses. What happens is you engage the cartel or they convince you to go, and they're going to charge you between $7,000 and $15,000 per person. Okay. If you're sitting in a third world country, you probably don't have that in your back pocket. So you're going to end up owing the cartels that. It's not a group I'd want to owe 50 cents to, much less thousands of dollars to. And everywhere along the way, you pay another toll. So if you're coming up from Central America or South America, there's some pretty rough area there. So there's some tour guides, in air quotes, that will help you through for the right dollar amount. There's some places that the cartels have set up for you to stay at and get fed at, but all of that costs money. And the reason why Yuma particularly right now is having these high numbers is because the wall system between here and the Pacific Ocean is fairly well complete. So there's nowhere to cross easily west of us. So we're the first opportunity they have. And along the border, every segment of the border is owned by a plaza boss, which is part of the cartel, but runs a different part of the business. And they have different relationships with different cartels and different subgroups in the cartels. And that's how they kind of put the travel arrangements together. So we have found airline tickets from all the way as far as like India or Asia, where they fly into Mexico City. Then they fly from Mexico City to Mexicali, which is 40 miles from here. And then they cross into Yuma. And then normally the plan is to get picked up by Border Patrol, because after about 2 to 3 days, they will issue you an order to appear for a court date for immigration. And then they release you on your own recognizance to go to a host. Ideally, the host is supposed to be a family member, a brother, a mother, or something like that. Usually, it's a member of the cartel. And so they pick you back up on the other end, and you owe them $10,000, $15,000, whatever it is at the end of the trip. And so now they're going to make sure that whatever you're doing, they're either getting paid back. That's kind of the process. To be frank, I don't know a single American who think that's the right process for immigration, but that is the actual process that's happening.
My wife, Calista, when she was the ambassador to the Vatican, spent a substantial amount of time on the whole issue of human trafficking. And I've heard various reports about the degree to which one of the ways people pay back the debt is either going into prostitution or in some other form of human trafficking. Do you get much sense of that as they come across the border?
We do. And when I say we, Border Patrol doesn't talk. So this is some people who have interviewed people that have come across the border, but some people that are trying to get their family to come across. And so they actually stay in Mexico and prostitute themselves in order to get enough money to pay the cartels to get people to cross. You hear routinely about abuse and rape as they're coming across, and we have an advocacy center here who's completely powerless. They can take the report, but it all happened in another country, and there's no way to help the victims. There's extortion, kidnapping. Sometimes they'll have people rent their kids out, essentially send them, once they get into the country, they'll send them as just the individual child back to Mexico to come across with another family. That pays about $400 to $500 off their tab. But now this kid is being re-trafficked for the second time or fourth time, and this is a repeating thing, to come into the country, assuming Border Patrol doesn't figure out that that's not really the parents.
So you get, like, in October, November of last year, 44,500 people. How many of them stay in Yuma, and where do the rest of them go?
So very few stay in Yuma. I'm not actually aware of any of them who have stayed in Yuma. They're usually headed to the southeast part of the country. Even those that came from Haiti or Cuba, they'll fly all the way across the continent just to traverse all the way back across the continent. They'll go any place in the country, actually. I've heard in Massachusetts, there's quite a bit of activity, the state of Washington. So it is a border problem, but it's also a whole country problem, because it's not 250,000 people I'm afraid are going to take up residence in Yuma. It's 250,000 people who are going to be coming through Yuma on their way to the other 49 states.
I've been trying to wrestle with this for a couple of weeks now, that you've had well over almost 2 million people now who've come across illegally since January of 2021. And I can't figure out where they're going, and apparently the U.S. government refuses to say where they're going.
Right. And the reality is they know, because before someone can be released upon their own recognizances, they have to give a destination. They have to say, who's the host family? Because that's how they set where their immigration court's going to be. So they don't make them come back to Yuma for immigration court or to Arizona. If they're in Georgia, they go see immigration proceedings, whatever's close to where they are in Georgia. So they just kind of have melded into the fabric of the country. We suspect there's compounds of workers, of people. And I believe it was 2016, the Yuma Sector Border Patrol agents followed a group in this process. They all were headed to, I don't remember the state, but it was the southeast part of the country. They were supposedly completely unrelated, didn't know each other. And when they landed and got out of the airplane, they all got picked up by the same van. The van drove down the road a little bit, pulled over, and this was back when we were putting GPS anklets on everyone. They threw out the GPS anklets and they threw out the paperwork. Well, that paperwork is their only proof that they're in this country legally. And they got back in the van and they drove to a compound of some mobile trailers. So essentially what they've done is they've made them invisible, because without having that paper, you can exploit them, but they're not going to run to tell the cops because they think they're going to be repatriated without their hearing because they don't have that paperwork anymore. So it's a great way to exploit people. It's a great way to traffic people. And we've facilitated that as a country, if you really step back and look at it.
So when they leave Yuma, how many of them are like in private vehicles? How many of them are like on buses or trains? How are they physically getting out?
The overwhelming majority is buses and planes. Every once in a while, you'll have a relative or someone who claims to be a relative show up and pick somebody up directly. But for the most part, right now, almost everyone's leaving on a plane, which is interesting perspective and a change from what we saw even in 2019 when we had a surge during that time. We had definitely poor people coming through in 2019. 2021, 22, people are coming across with Gucci bags. They're coming across with a lot more resources. Everyone's got a phone. Actually, they're coming across with three or four bags like they're getting on an airplane. So it's definitely kind of a different mix than what we're used to locally. But of course, the numbers are dramatically different.
So they're actually paying for their own tickets. It's not the U.S. government shipping them around?
That's my understanding. I've heard rumors contrary to that, but I've not been able to confirm that the government's paying for it.
You clearly had an impact, at least in terms of national media, when you declared an emergency. And I know that Governor Ducey has come down and that Senator Kelly's gotten involved. Has anything actually happened? I mean, has the federal government been responsive to your expression of concern?
Well, there's been a little bit of activity. We had the new commissioner of CBP come here, Mangus, and he's just gotten on the job. So he's been on the job 3 weeks when he showed up. That's the highest ranking official we've had that's met with the community on this since January of 21. We did have 110 extra agents surge to the border. They came from the northern border where the activity is a lot less, and they repositioned them here for a time. And now there is active discussions about closing up some of the gaps in the fence. We have 52 gates not installed. And when I say gates, think of Jurassic Park gates. They're huge. And 7 miles of fence not constructed. We also have the majority of the technical side not activated. So there's been discussions I've had with the secretary's office about patching that up. And there's been a lot of other discussions going on about the same thing.
I read when you made your statement, I read that there were these gates. So you have a wall, but that you have a totally open gate. I mean, it's fairly hard to be dumber than this. When you talk to them about that and show them that, I mean, what's their argument for not just putting on the gates?
Well, I don't press them on an argument because I think that's taken by the president when the president signed the executive order to suspend all the construction. But so it depends on who you're talking to. If you're talking to the politically appointed official, they've got a political answer. If you're talking to a lifelong DHS employee, they're a bit more sympathetic because they've been there. They understand what's going on. But again, it came out of the White House, so they're not going to readily counteract or countermand anything coming from the White House.
So if you could wave a magic wand, because you're living this, I mean, you're right there, you're at the heart of the action. If you could wave a magic wand, how would you solve it?
Wow, that's a big wand. We would definitely start with finishing off the barriers. You know, you need to have the gates put in place. You need to have as much as you can get fixed, including electronics and the surveillance side. And you need to have more agents until this thing settles down. You know, the Border Patrol's mission is border security. It's not immigration security. And so they have not been able to do their mission for almost a year. They need to be able to do their mission. So we need to find a mechanism to get them back to their mission and someone else handling immigration. Ultimately, though, and you, Speaker, know this better than I, it needs to come from Congress. We need to have some stronger and updated immigration rules that are then followed by strong policy that gives the authority to our boots on the ground to get things done the way they should be done to support the laws. Without border security and then without reformed policy and legislation, I don't see this really dramatically changing any direction.
Now, you do have a problem of sheer numbers, but do folks in Yuma feel endangered or do they feel insecure?
You know, in general, because Border Patrol does such a great job of containing everything, they generally do not. Now, there are some that live close to the border that have hired some security and those kind of things just on the chance that something were to happen. And we've seen some increase on some of the local petty crime as far as, you know, some fights and those kind of things at the shelters. But for the most part, the average person who lives in Yuma doesn't have direct engagement, maybe until just this last month, month and a half, with people walking on the streets. That's a little bit different, but I've not heard too much. I mean, that's part of the yin and the yang of this discussion is when I declare an emergency and I make a big deal out of it, it sounds like Yuma's overran to the point of, you know, having police on the corner and on every corner to try to keep law and order. That's not the case. Yuma's still a great place to live, to visit. I haven't changed any of the way I live. And I'm not concerned about, you know, my kids doing what they've been doing. So it's not that security risk, but it could give that perception nationally that that's what's going on.
It's fascinating. And of course, as you were saying, as the immigrants who come in have changed from the much poorer immigrants we saw a few years ago, I loved your one line, the people who come in with their Gucci bag, they probably aren't a threat as such. I don't think I ever quite imagined I'd live in the world as it's been evolving. I'm sure when you ran for mayor for the first time, you had no notion that this was all going to come down on you.
No, not at all. And between the pandemic and two migrant emergencies, I'm good for a normal year or two. I would love to have something like that. I will mention, so we talk about the vast numbers of people coming through. There's about a 5 to 10% segment of the people coming through that look to evade. They are the ones we have to worry about. And the only way you can address that is with the secure border, which is, again, what Border Patrol is supposed to be doing. Because they're the ones running the drugs. They're the ones involved in picking up people for the sex trade, for running the money, or criminals coming into the country. You can't catch those people when you're tied up with people who only want an immigration change. And that's a huge concern. If anything should concern people, that should concern people. We caught someone on the terrorist watch list here a couple of weeks ago coming through the Border Patrol station. That's not, you know, your farmer from Ecuador trying to make a better living.
I got a briefing a few weeks ago that you now have pattern from Haiti into Brazil, and also, I think, from Haiti to Ecuador, which does not require a visa as long as you have a passport. And then you move north to Colombia, then across the jungle to Panama and so forth. Then there's a second track, which comes from West Africa, across into Brazil. And then there's the classic track, which comes straight up along Central America and which has a substantial number of Hondurans and Guatemalans and El Salvadorians. But it's much more complex, much more sophisticated. I had an expert from Gallup who has lived in Costa Rica for the last 30 years who was describing the decision of some of the cartels to give up drugs for people and to specialize in becoming people movers, and in Mexico to run sort of the equivalent of an Airbnb so that as you're going north, they'll actually stop and you'll stay at some place and they'll feed you and take care of you. And they actually have people who will come along and say, now, has your trip been okay? Are we doing all right by you? Do you have any complaints? But the other side of that is, they said, in an amazing number of places like in Long Island, there will be specific designated stores, and you will have arrived owing $6,000 because your uncle has said that he would make sure you got a job. So you go every month to that store, and you pay the amount you owe on your total debt. And in dealing with the cartel, the incentive program for paying is very high.
It's called life.
But this whole thing now is a system that's just astonishing.
They estimate the Yuma sector, the Border Patrol Yuma sector alone, experiences over $16 million a week in business.
Wow.
So just that's 130-mile section of the southern border produces $16 million.
That's over $800 million a year just in that one sector.
It's tough to turn that spigot off, right?
Yeah.
There's going to be people who are going to be adamantly against that, which is, I don't know how that works into the equation, but I think that has an influence on the path to the United States.
Well, and then there, as you pointed out, there are the people, if you think of it as a river, there are people in the middle of the river who are bringing fentanyl and they're bringing cocaine and they're bringing heroin or they're bringing terrorists. I mean, there's a lot of complexities to what's going on. Listen, I want to thank you. You're terrific. I'm delighted. You're exactly what America needs. We are only as strong as our local governments and our local leaders. And the great strength of this country has not ever been in Washington. It's actually been out across the whole country. And I really want to wish you and the citizens of Yuma a terrific year. You're showing great courage. It was very important that you spoke out when you did. I hope the federal government will assist you. And I appreciate your helping educate the country on what's going on.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. It's a pleasure and honor to meet you, and just knowing that we're not out here alone fighting our own battles, that there's people across the country that understand and want to understand more. Thank you very much for everything.
Thank you to my guest, Mayor Douglas Nichols. You can learn more about Yuma, Arizona and the migrant surge on our show page at NewtsWorld.com. NewtsWorld is produced by Gingrich 360 and iHeartMedia. Our executive producer is Garnsey Sloan. Our producer is Rebecca Howell, and our researcher is Rachel Peterson. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penley. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360. If you've been enjoying Newt's World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. Right now, listeners of Newt's World can sign up for my 3 free weekly columns at gingrich360.com/newsletter. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World.